I want you to picture a relay race. Probably the most important relay race in human history, actually. You have this towering giant of a runner, Plater, and he's been running his leg of the race, holding the baton, but he's running while looking straight up at the sky. He's telling everyone that the track we're running on, that it isn't real, that the real race is happening somewhere up in the clouds.
Which makes passing the baton a little tricky.
Exactly. So he reaches the exchange zone and passes the baton to his student, Aristotle. And you'd expect Aristotle to grab it and just keep looking up, right? To, keep the tradition going.
You would think so, yeah.
But he doesn't. He grabs the baton, stops dead, looks down at the ground, and basically says, you know what? I think you've been looking in the wrong direction this whole time.
That's honestly the perfect way to frame it. You know that famous painting, The School of Athens?
Oh, by Raphael.
Yeah, by
The
Raphael.
one with all the philosophers in togas hanging out on the steps.
That's the one. In the center, you have Plato pointing up, and right next to him, you have Aristotle with his hand flat, palm down, pointing at the earth. For a long time, people thought they were just, I don't know, striking cool poses, but that hand gesture, it's actually a declaration of
The
war.
war over reality itself.
Truly, it's the exact moment Western philosophy pivots from the heavens down to the earth. And well, that's our mission for this deep dive. We are bridging the gap between Plato's conclusions and the launch of Aristotle's metaphysics.
Which is a massive shift.
Huge. And to do this, we're working off a really brilliant lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes that unpacks this whole transition. He connects the dots on how we went from these abstract ideals to a grounded scientific approach.
So let's start with the guy pointing up, Plato. Dr. Holmes uses this analogy of a wheel to explain how Plato's brain worked. He calls it the hub of the wheel.
Yeah, visualizing it is really helpful here. If you imagine a wagon wheel, the central hub, the thing that holds the entire structure together, is Plato's core thesis. He calls it the divided line.
Okay, let's unpack that. What exactly is the line dividing?
It's the strict separation between knowledge and opinion.
Okay.
For Plato, knowledge with a capital K is only about the eternal forms, those perfect, unchanging ideals floating up in the sky. Opinion, on the other hand, is everything else. It's the messy, changing physical world we actually live in.
So, like the chair I'm sitting on, the coffee I'm drinking, that's all just opinion.
To Plato, yes.
Yeah.
To his shadow. It's not fully real because it changes and eventually it breaks. The only real things are the perfect abstract ideas of a chair or coffee that exist in the realm of forms.
Okay, so if that's the hub of the wheel, what are the spokes?
Well, the spokes are everything else in human life. Ethics, politics, psychology, cosmology, they all radiate out from that one central belief.
Makes sense.
Because if you believe the physical world is just a flawed shadow, that dictates how you run a government. It dictates how you treat your body and even how you view history.
Right, let's talk about history because this part of the lecture really surprised me. I mean, we were so used to thinking of history as a timeline.
A straight line forward.
Exactly. We move forward. We invent the smartphone. We cure diseases. Things generally get better. That's progress. But Plato didn't see it that way at all, did he?
Not even a little bit. See, because the material world is flawed, because it's not ruled perfectly by reason, it automatically contains the seeds of its own destruction. So for Plato, history isn't a line, it's a cycle.
A wheel.
Right? It's a wheel that keeps turning. You have integration, and then you inevitably have disintegration.
Round and round the mulberry burst.
Dr. Holmes actually uses that exact phrase, and Plato maps this out very specifically with governments. It's this cycle of regimes that decay, collapse, and restart.
Walk us through that cycle. Where does it start?
It starts with aristocracy. Now, don't think of wealthy people in powdered wigs here. He means rule by the honorable or the spirited, the best and the brightest.
Like the philosopher kings.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
But because nothing in the physical world lasts, the rulers eventually lose their way. They get arrogant, they get greedy, and the society slides into tyranny, which is ruled by force and repression.
Which usually doesn't last long because people generally hate being repressed.
Correct. So the tyrant is overthrown by the masses, and you get democracy.
Okay, finally, power to the people. That sounds like the happy ending to the story.
You would think so, but here's where Plato is incredibly cynical. He outright calls democracy mob rule.
Mob rule. That feels a little harsh considering we usually frame democracy as the pinnacle of civilization.
It does sound harsher to us, but you have to remember his context. He watched a democratic vote sentence his beloved teacher, Socrates, to death.
Oh, right. That would sour you on the concept.
Definitely. So Plato viewed democracy as rule by the appetitive. meaning people driven by their base desires, easily manipulated by demagogues who just tell them whatever they want to hear.
So it's fundamentally unstable.
Highly unstable. It's a chaotic mess. And eventually, a few powerful people rise to the top to restore some kind of order and becomes an oligarchy ruled by the few, which eventually stabilizes back into an aristocracy, and the wheel spins all over again.
So there's no winning. We're just trapped on a political hamster wheel.
That's the major takeaway from Plato's view of history. There is no historical progress, just endless cycles of rising and falling. And what's fascinating is that this cyclical view applies to you personally, too, to your soul.
This brings us to the famous chariot analogy, right?
It does. Plato pictures the human soul as a charioteer driving two winged horses. You're trying to fly up toward the sun, which represents the good, the true, and the beautiful. You want to escape this physical world.
But there's a catch.
Right. You have this unruly horse representing your base physical instincts that constantly drags you down. You lose your wings, you fall back to earth, and you get trapped in a body. Reincarnation and repetition.
Trapped is a really strong word.
But it's Plato's word. He views the body as a literal prison house. A tomb.
Man, he really had a beef with the physical body.
He thought it was the source of all distraction. There's this incredible anecdote about Socrates in the source material. When he's about to be executed, he's calm, happy even. He basically thanks his executioners. Yeah, he says something to the effect of, "Thank you for getting rid of this body so I can finally think clearly."
Thanks for killing me. I have work to do. That is intense.
It shows just how deep the divide was in Greek thought. Contrast that cyclical, body-hating view with the linear view that comes later with Judeo-Christian thinkers, like St. Augustine, where history is actually moving toward a destiny. Dr. Holmes mentions a story from the Book of Acts that illustrates this cultural clash perfectly.
Oh, the one with the Apostle Paul.
Yes. Paul is in Athens, preaching to these Greek philosophers who were completely steeped in Plato's ideas. They're listening politely, nodding along, until Paul mentions the resurrection of the body.
And that's the deal breaker.
Immediate rain check. They literally laughed him out of the room. To a Greek mind obsessed with escaping the material world, the idea that you would want your body back after dying was completely absurd. Why would you want to go back to prison?
So what's the unifying force in all this for Plato? If you hate the world and your body, what keeps you going?
Love. Yes. But not romantic love in the modern sense. For Plato, love is the drive, the motivation to reach the good, the beautiful, and the true. It's a unifying virtue. Just as a person in love can only think of their beloved and focuses all their energy there, the love of the good focuses all your spiritual energy upward.
Upward. Always pointing up. So let's recap the Plato situation. We are stuck in a political cycle that goes nowhere. We are trapped in a body that we hate. And our only goal is to use love to escape to some abstract up there. I mean, it's poetic, sure, but it's also kind of depressing.
It leaves you with a lot of longing and very little footing in the real world. And this is exactly where his student, Aristotle, raises his hand and says, "I think there's a better way to live right here."
Enter the scientist.
Exactly. Aristotle was Plato's student for 20 years. He loved the guy, but he was fundamentally a different kind of thinker. He pushed the whole philosophical project in a corrected direction. If Plato was the poet, writing myths and likely stories and beautiful dialogues, Aristotle was the scientist.
He was a biologist at heart.
Through and through. His writing is succinct, detailed, and highly systematic.
The source makes a really funny comparison about their writing styles, actually. He says reading Aristotle is like doing the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle.
Oh, honestly, it's worse than that. It's like doing the crossword in ancient Greek, and half the clues are completely made up words. Dr. Holmes mentions that Aristotle basically tortures the Greek language.
Tortures it how? What does he do?
Well, he turns questions into technical nouns. For example, instead of asking, "What is this thing?" Plato talks about the "what is it," which is the phrase we eventually translate as essence. He's wrestling with language to describe scientific and structural concepts that no one had ever described before.
And the biggest word associated with him is metaphysics, which I have to admit sounds spooky, like crystals and ghosts and stuff.
It does have that reputation now, but the origin story of the word is hilarious. It's literally just a filing error.
Wait, a filing error?
Yeah. Aristotle never actually used the word metaphysics. He wrote a bunch of notes on physics, you know, nature, movement, the stars. And then he had a separate stack of notes about being and reality that didn't neatly fit anywhere else.
So what happened?
Later editors just placed those notes after the physics notes on the shelf. In Greek, the word meta just means after. So metaphysics literally just means the stuff filed after the physics.
That is fantastic. The most intimidating word in philosophy just means the sequel to physics.
Exactly. But despite the accidental name, the definition he gives it is very serious. He calls metaphysics the science of being qua being.
Okay, being qua being. You're going to have to translate that for.
Qua just means as. So he's studying being as being. Think of it like this. A biologist studies living things. A mathematician studies countable things. Aristotle asked, who studies the thingness of things? Before you can be a cat or a star or a table, you have to be.
He wanted to hack the source code of reality itself, not just look at the apps running on it.
That's a great way to put it. To Aristotle, there are different types of knowledge. Hmm. You have practical knowledge, which has instrumental value.
Like arts, crafts, experience.
Right. The goal of practical knowledge is action. But then you have theoretical knowledge, which has intrinsic value. It's speculative. The goal is truth and understanding for its own sake. And metaphysics is the ultimate theoretical knowledge. He called it first wisdom.
He wants to know the rules of the operating system. And this is where he really starts picking a fight with his old teacher. Because he looks at Plato's forms, those perfect ideals floating in the heavens, and he says, this code doesn't work.
This is the great divorce. Aristotle brings up some devastating critiques of Plato's theories. One of the main ones is the math argument.
Right, the coin thing.
Exactly. Aristotle looks at a round gold coin. Plato would say, the roundness of this coin is just a shadow. The real circle exists in the world of forms, completely separate from the gold. Aristotle looks at it and says, no, if I melt this coin down, the roundness disappears. The math isn't floating in another dimension. It's anchored right here in the material.
So if mathematical objects like triangles or triads exist in material things, the form must be here too. They can't be separate from matter.
Precisely. You can't separate the shape from the object. But the critique that really stuck, the one that really dismantled Plato's heaven, was the effective power argument.
This is the practical scientist coming out again.
He asks a very basic question. If the forms are just perfect, frozen ideals in another dimension, how do they actually do anything? How does a perfect abstract idea of a tree reach down and make a physical acorn grow?
Right, because ideally, forms are static. They don't move. But our world is full of change and growth.
And Plato has no engine for that change.
He has a perfect blueprint, but no contractor to actually build the house.
Exactly. Plato tries to explain it away with myths about a world soul, but Aristotle completely dismisses that. He says it's just unscientific storytelling. He needs a real mechanism. So he proposes a solution. And this is the big technical term for the day, hylomorphism.
Hylomorphism. It sounds like a monster from a Godzilla movie. Break it down for us.
It comes from two Greek words, hyle, meaning matter, and morphe, meaning form. Aristotle says you cannot have one without the other. A reality, whether it's a cat, a cabbage, or a king, is not just matter copying a form. It is a composite. It is form and matter together.
Give me an example to make this stick.
Think of a wax seal. You have the wax, that's the matter, so it's a blob on its own. Then you have the design, the crest, or the image pressed into it. That's the form. You can't have the seal without the wax, and the wax isn't a seal without the design. Aristotle says everything is a wax seal. You can't peel the form off and float it up to heaven.
So the form is immanent with an A. It's inside the thing itself.
That is the whale of a difference, as Dr. Holmes puts it. By moving the form inside the object, Aristotle changes everything. Because now the object isn't just a flawed shadow. It has an internal structure. It has power.
And this leads us to how he solves the problem of change. Because if the form is inside the thing, that means the instructions for what it's supposed to be are already in there. The mechanics of being.
Yes. This introduces the concepts of potency and telos. Having the form within gives the object potency, which means potential or power. The acorn has the power to become an oak tree. It's not an oak tree yet, but the oakness is inside it, driving it forward.
It has a goal.
Right. Telos, that means end or goal. The iris bulb has a telos to produce flowers. The form dictates the purpose. And this completely shifts the definition of the good.
Because for Plato, the good was that distant sun in the sky that you try to fly towards, trying to escape your body.
But for Aristotle, the good is when a thing successfully actualizes its internal potential right here on Earth.
So good isn't some abstract spiritual vibe anymore. A good eye is an eye that sees. A good acorn is one that becomes a tree.
Exactly. It's about flourishing. When a thing actualizes its potential, it flourishes. The lecture actually has a funny line about this. Dr. Holmes says, if the iris bulb doesn't bloom, if it doesn't achieve its telos, it belongs in the garbage. it has failed its purpose.
That's a very grounded, almost biological way to look at the universe. It's not about escaping the world anymore. It's about being the best version of what you are in the world.
And that's why this shift from Plato to Aristotle is so monumental. We move from Plato's wheel of history and his flight from the body to Aristotle's grounded view where form and matter are totally inseparable. The goal is to grow, to develop, to flourish right here.
It literally paved the way for how we classify the world today. Species, genus, the scientific method, it all comes from looking at physical things and asking, what is the essence of this? What is its purpose?
It grounded Western thought. We stopped looking solely at the stars and started looking at the biology around us. We started asking how things work in reality, not just what they represent in theory.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, this brings up a really sticky question for us today. Aristotle suggests that everything has a specific essence that dictates its purpose. An acorn's essence makes it an oak. A bulb's essence makes it a flower.
It raises the ultimate question, doesn't it?
It does. Because if we follow Aristotle's framework, a human being has an essence too. He famously defined us as the rational animal. So here's the provocative thought to leave you with. If your telos, your built-in purpose, is to use reason, are you actually doing it?
Aristotle would say that a good eye sees and a good acorn grows. So if you are a human who isn't thinking, who isn't using that reason, are you, by definition, a bad human?
Under this framework, what specifically is the essence of a human being? Are you flourishing or are you just existing? Something to think about while you sit in traffic. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Keep thinking, everyone.
See you next time.